On this podcast, we share a lot of stories, and often the mental health aspect of the work we do creeps in. If you think you might be feeling depressed, stressed, anxious, or even overwhelmed, please consider visiting our sponsor, BetterHelp. BetterHelp offers licensed therapists who are trained to listen and help you. And they even have therapists who specifically work with first responders. You just fill out a questionnaire to help assess your specific needs, and then you get matched with a therapist in under 48 hours. You can talk to your therapist in a private and online environment at your convenience. Many first responders work rotating and often odd schedules, so this format makes it really easy to talk to someone when it's convenient for you. If you don't click with your therapist, you can request a new one at no additional charge anytime. Join the 3 million plus people who have taken charge of their mental health with an experienced BetterHelp therapist. Get 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/Rhody. That's betterhelp.com/Rhody, R-O-A-D-I-E. You can also find the link in the show notes.
You got to find a way to not really forget the memories, but know how to deal with them.
On the trolley side, just a little bit of fire lit.
They clear a path. I say, holy cow, they made a path for us.
If you put a couple of first responders together in a room, something interesting happens. Before too long, they'll begin sharing stories. They're not trying to one-up each other. They're simply finding common ground. I was fortunate enough to serve my community as a paramedic and a firefighter for over 25 years. As you can imagine, during that time, I acquired my fair share of stories about the incidents and the calls I was involved in. I thought I might write a book, but then I decided sharing these stories collectively in a podcast would give anyone listening an insider's view into the work that first responders do every single day. These are the stories of the men and women who courageously serve the public. Or as I like to call them, stories from the road. Welcome back to Stories from the Road. I'm your host, Phil Klein, and this morning I'm joined with someone who's not a first responder, but certainly has a story to share and a story that I think all first responders will relate to. So, Kayla, welcome to the podcast. We're going to jump in and let you tell your story, so I'll turn the mic over to you and let you share your story from the road.
First, thanks, Phil, for doing this, because I worry about people forgetting. It's just important. I think every person in America should go to the 9/11 Museum, because no matter where you were that day, it puts you exactly where you were, and for younger generations to understand the lessons and appreciation for our first responders and our military. So on September 10th, 2001, I was at JFK Airport with my boss, Neil Levin, who is the executive director of the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey. We were there with an editorial board writer from the New York Times. His name was Andreas Martinez. We were talking about redevelopment of the TWA building and building a convention center. We spent a few hours there, and then he said, come on, I'll give you a ride back into the city. I lived on the other side of Manhattan from him, and he's dropping me off, and I'm saying, well, I don't know if I should go to the gym or watch TV. He said, go to the gym, and I'm going to a bakery. That's the last time I talked to him. September 11th, I just voted. I saw Michael Bloomberg and Rudy Giuliani at the polling place. It was a beautiful blue sky. And when I got out of the train from the World Trade Center, it was just a beautiful blessing to see the blue striding across the World Trade Center Plaza. Just what a breathtaking view.
Now, the night before, and it's, you talked about it a little bit, but the night before, September 10th, was not a beautiful night. It was a horrible storm. I was at Yankee Stadium that night. I remember sitting there. I was with my friend John. Roger Clemens was supposed to pitch, and I remember watching Joe Torre. I think they were playing Boston that night, too. I remember watching Joe Torre walk out onto the field, across the outfield with the umpire, with the manager of the Red Sox. And, you know, it had rained for hours, and they finally had called the night. And I'll share my day before September 11th story, if you don't mind. My wife was pregnant with our first child, and because the game was called, I had a little bit of time on my hands. So I went to the gift shop, or to the clubhouse store, and I bought a little baby Yankee hat. for my, I don't know if I was having a boy or a girl, but I bought a little baby Yankee hat. And I was able to do that because people were leaving and it wasn't very crowded. But that's what I remember, is that torrential downpour that came through the night before. And then I remember the Tuesday morning was a cool, crisp morning. And it was so clear. It was that clear that you get right after a rainstorm comes through and pushes everything out. And you get this cool, you know, these incredible blue skies, this cool day. And I will never forget that.
Go Yankees.
And go Yankees.
So at the time, I was the director of public affairs for the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey. My office had just moved from the 73rd floor to the 68th floor. I had a corner office with a view of the Statue of Liberty, which I probably had taken a little bit for granted. So anyway, I'm at my desk getting ready for a meeting with my boss, Neil Levin, and some consultants to talk about totally revamping the website. So I'm sitting at my desk, and all of a sudden the building lunges forward about 10 feet, and then it comes back. And a few minutes later, I see all this debris coming down from the top of the building. It was as if someone was dumping trash from that floor. I guess it was 107th floor. And I called both governor's offices. I said, something is happening here. And I'm not sure yet. Probably a small plane might have bumped into the building. Then I go to call my boss, Neil Levin, called his house. His wife says, try his pager, his BlackBerry. She said he was at a meeting. And Windows on the World.
And Windows on the World is where?
107th floor of One World Trade Center. So I put into place, after all those drills following the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, I had sent staff to the Marriott, which was on the World Trade Center site. Pencils, pens, our flash drive with the business continuity plan. And finally, after a little while, security guard comes and he says, your life is in danger. We have to leave. I said, well, give me a minute to turn off my computer. Again, thinking it's a small plane. That was the mindset at that time. And so we walked the floor. I had a person who had physical challenges. Want to make sure she was evacuated. There was no one else on the floor. And then start going down the stairs. Meanwhile, again on this BlackBerry, it was before all these smartphones. I said, are you there at the Marriott yet? They were about 30 minutes ahead of me. They were only a few floors ahead of me, despite having left earlier. So I thought it was a little strange. I had sent text to senior staff saying we were going to the Marriott, which is where we had set up in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. And I reached out to my PIOs, told them the same thing. And then, like I said, the firemen were going up, the police officers were going up, and then we saw some of the police officers coming down the steps helping people. And it was very orderly, number one, because we did drills, and number two, because we had this glow-in-the-dark tape. That was one of the things that came out of the 1993 bombing. So all we needed to do was follow this tape, and as first responders were going up and down, all we needed to do was step aside. So we're going down, and I see a colleague from aviation department. We're talking, going down, until we got to about the sixth floor. That's when we knew the South Tower had imploded. And our building twisted, and we were stuck. The stairwell was blocked. That's the moment you're going to meet your maker. And I was very calm. You never know how you're going to act in those situations. And all of a sudden, Port Authority Police Officer David Lim pops out of nowhere, a couple of stories above us. And he says, follow me, follow me. Well, the idea of going up after the other tower had come down was not inviting. But we knew, because the Port Authority built the World Trade Center, the cops and the World Trade Center folks, they knew the ins and outs. So he took us through this maze, climbing the desk, the debris, the lines everywhere, and he took us to another stairwell. We're going down. At this point, the chillers that cooled the air conditioners had burst, and there was water coming down. It was like the rapids. And so they had us hold on to the person ahead of us to go slow, and then they would open a door to the Invezi Street, the floor level, and let people go in groups. Somehow we lost the group in front of us, and this room was white. It was as if there was fresh fallen snow everywhere. The ceilings, the walls, the floor, it was surreal. And the people I was with started to scream. I said, "Don't scream, because the stuff is coming down. Let's look for footprints." After a few minutes, no footprints. Then I said, "It's time to scream." So we're looking around, and all of a sudden we see this light. And it was on the side of the building. They said, "If you can see this light, and if you can hear my voice, it must have been someone on a bullhorn. Follow the light." So they took us outside to, I guess it was 7 World Trade Center, along the overhang, underneath the overhang of the building, and just seeing the damage, the destruction. It seemed like a third world country. How could that happen on American soil? And so we're walking along the building. We get to these stairs, 13 tons of concrete, and we go down the stairs. We're at Church Invezi. So we hit the ground level, trying to breathe in my pumps and my skirt, and all of a sudden a police officer says, "Run." I said, "I just spent 45 minutes in the stairwell. What do you mean, run?" And all of a sudden I turn back, and here comes this plume of thick black. The North Tower was coming down. I ran 16 blocks to the Holland Tunnel as fast probably as I did my whole life. And so we dove under the car because of the plume. And when the plume seemed to dissipate to a degree, we knocked on a merchant's door and asked for water. And then I went back on the BlackBerry, and I told my staff, I said, "We're going to our police headquarters in New Jersey, just over the Holland Tunnel." And so I flagged down a Port Authority police officer who took us through the Port Authority police headquarters just on the other side. We go in. I'm like, "Where is Fred Marone, the superintendent of police?" And I just went down the leadership role, and turns out they were at a conference in the North Tower. And they went up the elevators trying to get to my boss, Neil Levin, on the 107th floor. They were all wiped out. So I just waited for some of the staff to come. We didn't know who was dead. We didn't know who was alive. But slowly my staff started to come. And some of the other emergency staff and police officers said, "It's not safe here because of the proximity to the Holland Tunnel." No one knew if the attacks were over. So we moved to another Port Authority facility, Journal Square Transportation Facility, and we just started dropping lines. We knew my job was to deal with the news media and the elected officials. We knew this was going to be a long game. And I see the chief operating officer, Ernesto Butcher, he comes in covered in soot. And I learned that he was one of the senior staff that I sent to the Marriott, and the ceiling fell down on him. I have a little guilt from that. Thank God he was alive. And he pulled me aside after he changed clothes. He says, "Kayla, I need your help, whatever you need." He said, "We need to figure out who's dead and who's alive." And I'm trying to think this through. I mean, there were chains to call people, but we didn't know the status. And so I called a friend from another department, government affairs. And I said, well, first of all, I called her. I didn't know if she was in or not. Turns out she was in the last PATH train from New Jersey to New York, and they stopped the train. She didn't know if I was dead or alive. I said, Norma, I need you to come in. I have a job for you. She came in, and what we decided to do in the early hours was to set up an Excel spreadsheet. And we set up two telephone numbers in a vanilla website, just with a white page. The news media in this instance were helpful. We set up one phone number for staff to know where to report to, and the second number was for relatives. If they hadn't heard from their loved ones, call them. And slowly, as staffers called in, it was a big cheer. It was a big cheer. And as the Human Relations Department came in, I moved back to my role. I called both governor's offices. I said, I'm going to need PIOs probably for the next 6 months. And we knew my boss was gone. And then there became a fight between the two states about who would head the Port Authority and the worst of the worst situations. Who was going to head the Port Authority Police Department? And essentially, we work from rescue to recovery to rebuilding. The 9/11 Commission hearings were lethal. You had family members pointing at us directly saying, Port Authority, you killed my son. You killed my daughter. And that's the point I told myself. I should be grateful to be alive. That's what some of the families told me. And that's the point I decided I would just minimize whatever I'd gone through. I just kept working. And so after that, we focused on the rebuilding. Build the towers, don't build the towers. As New Yorkers, there's a diversity of opinion on every single thing, from elected officials to community boards to the folks who live downtown. It was daunting. But what we decided to do was hold a worldwide competition of architects. And we received several submissions, and we proactively held about 25 town hall meetings and made the presentation. And slowly by slowly, we whittled it down. And the determination by the city and the state was, we have to rebuild because of the economy. New York would flounder for the long term, tremendous loss of jobs. And so we decided that, or the public decided with us, we're not going to rebuild the towers. But we can build something that represents the best of America, and that's where the Freedom Tower came into play, and rebuilding all the other buildings. The PATH station was restored within 60 months on time, on budget, and a few years later, basically, the office moved from New Jersey to Union Square, and a couple of years later, I was offered a job in Florida, working for this obscure agency called the South Florida Water Management District, which is leading the drive to restore the Everglades, which I thought was phenomenal to see polluted water get cleansed by trees and brush and plants. It was miraculous. And I loved that job. I was there 5 years until the housing bubble. It burst, and there were $180 million in layoffs at my agency. I was a victim. Public affairs is the first to go. At the same time, a few years prior, my brother, he survived Katrina. He bicycled off the levees, and my dad picked him up and brought him to Atlanta. He had been in Atlanta about a year, and he's driving home one day to his apartment, had a heart attack, and died right there in the apartment complex, and he wasn't found till a couple of days because the residents thought he was sleeping. At the same time, my mother was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer, and she and my dad were in Georgia at that time. And that's when the wheels fell off. When that bad news coupled with being laid off, that's when all the intensity came to the fore, because I was always busy staying in that work mode. And that's when I had DUI number one in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. But I didn't think I had a problem. I just thought it was, you know, bad. It was just bad timing. It was a fluke. And as my mother was dying, I traveled between Florida and Georgia. Meanwhile, all my savings gone. I lose my condo, and my mother dies. And so I move here with my 80-year-old father, since I'm the single one in the family. And it's January 2017, DUI number two, less than a mile from my house. And again, I thought it was a fluke until I went to court, Forsyth County Court, and I entered a program called a CARE program. It's for dual diagnosis. That's where I got the diagnosis for PTSD. So I have a lot of resentment for that World Trade Center Health Network, who hasn't done diddly for, I wasn't a uniformed person, but there are a lot of people out there who are just walking around with mental health, substance abuse problems, and there's no one there for them. And so this program really saved my life. That's where I got the diagnosis. That's where I got the treatment. And I never heard of a program like this before. I spent 3 years in the program, and it was well worth it. So after that, here comes COVID. I knew I needed to stay busy because of my PTSD. So I started volunteering at this place called The Connection. It's a recovery community organization, and that's where they help people either coming out of jail or in trouble with the law, or just walk in and they say they have a problem with substance abuse, or there's a family member with substance abuse. And we had to close the building because of COVID, but we went into high gear with the Zoom meetings before they were very popular. So I did that for several months. Next thing you know, they offered me a job. Then I got my credentials, and I'm also in a program with NAMI. I speak out an advocacy against the stigma and just people not being afraid. I encourage people, if they got a problem or if they're overcoming either mental health or substance abuse, step up, because you're going to help somebody. It's hard to believe in 2022 this still exists. What I say is, because you have a problem, and if you recover, you're taxpayers. You contribute back to society. So I believe in second chance. It doesn't always work out for everybody, but it's a choice, and I'm grateful. So that's what I'm doing now, and I'm just grateful to be alive.
Yeah, I bet you are, and that is certainly an incredible story. It's a story of survival. And you know, I think I counted two or three times where it could have been the end for you, and you were able to get past it and move forward. But I think there's a narrative there, and that narrative is the long-term PTSD effects from something so traumatic in your life. You know, on this podcast, I talk to first responders, and we talk about how doing that job, whether they're law enforcement, fire, or EMS, affects them over time. And I think in your case, this is something that, while it was a long time, it was probably, what, 6 to 8 months that you were in this role trying to, you know, maybe even longer, and I'm not 100% sure, but, you know, there's got to be that accumulation of stress on you that manifested later on with the DUI. So it's great to see that you've overcome that you're doing something to give back at this point, but I can certainly understand where those triggers were and where that stress took its toll on you during that rebuilding process, or even during the recovery process and then the rebuilding process.
One of the things I've learned about PTSD, frankly, I was angry at myself that I didn't recognize signs earlier. But the only thing I knew about PTSD is that the military first responders had it, and I didn't know what it looked like. I know it looked like watching those shows, and you see the little cloud, and then there's a flashback. But I wasn't a first responder or military. I wasn't a victim of domestic violence, so it, never occurred to me. I didn't know what it looked like. And I guess it's a little different for everyone, but it made sense as I learned about the anxiety, sometimes night triggers, occasional flashbacks, but the anxiety was mostly through the roof. And there's some depression in there. But there's a lot of education that we need to do to show what it looks like. It's not necessarily the movies. And I guess if you're not affected by it directly or a loved one, you don't exactly know what it looks like.
I think even if you are affected by it, and like you said, you didn't recognize it in yourself. I know for me, I hadn't recognized it for a long time. And there's a lot of folks that I talk to that are really good at keeping it under control until they're not in that role anymore. So guys that retire all of a sudden are starting to have flashbacks and are starting to deal with things that they never dealt with during their 20 or 30 year career. So it's recognizing it in ourselves, not just recognizing it in other people. But again, it's education and, you know, figuring out what it looks like so that people can get treatment and hopefully not get to the point where they get themselves in trouble or hurt.
Definitely. And I would just say it's a stain on this country that it took a comedian in Jon Stewart to have to go shame the Congress of the United States to get treatment and help for these, you know, cancer and other conditions, life-threatening conditions, and many of them died waiting for treatment. That's just, there's no excuse for that. And, you know, these are the same politicians who are always with the little pendants, never forget, never forget. They're the ones looking for the photo opportunity. And so it's just hard to believe that our country has largely failed us in that regard.
And not just the politicians. I saw a picture the other day and someone was wearing a shirt or holding a sign, I forget, but it said the EPA lied to us. And you know as well as I do, how many months were they on the pile digging and being told the air was okay? And now all these firefighters and police officers and people that were involved in that site are all developing, you know, long-term effects of 9/11. And not getting the, well, until Jon Stewart, weren't getting the care or the treatment that they deserved.
And I think, you know, the VA, for all the talk about let's improve the VA and bring it to a higher level, I've heard some positive stories about the VA here in Atlanta, but all the other stories I hear are just the opposite. Someone was telling me the other day about a first responder. He was somewhere in New York, I want to say Staten Island. He tried to get in to see him, said that he was in a crisis situation. They were just overwhelmed. So he sat in his car and he committed suicide. It's just a metaphor for the treatment of our first responders and military. In this day and age, it's just, frankly, it's disgusting. And there's no excuse for that.
I agree with you 100%. The guys that are out there taking care of all of us are not being taken care of well enough by the people who should be looking after them.
And there was some, well, I needed a job, but it wasn't the same thing. My job was not to save people, to put my life in danger. But there were a lot of first responders who hadn't retired, who might have been okay to a degree. No jobs, no help. And so I just worry about those still out there whose voice hasn't been heard, because obviously with the terminal conditions, that's number one. But there are others who just sit quietly at home, no help, no help, no representation. When this all happened, I called a law firm for help. And the same law firm, they just live for profits off of the backs of the first responders and other people, putting all over their brochure how they care and they care, but their phone number is, you know, free consultation and all this other stuff. We can get you 30% or 40%. Something needs to happen. And even as a civilian, seeing people put on eBay prizes, so to speak, that they got pieces of steel from the World Trade Center, I have a hard time comprehending how people can profit off such a tragedy.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's disgusting. Well, Kayla, as we wrap this up, closing thought, what do you want to say?
I just want to say thank you, and I want people not to be ashamed to ask for help. It's just like cancer or any other thing, only you can't see it, and that's one of the issues, is if you can't see it, you must be okay. My father would tell people, if you met my daughter, you wouldn't even know she has PTSD. So I say more education, stand up for yourself, and ask for help. And people can contact me too. I'm on Facebook and Instagram. Anything I can do, if I can't help, I'll point you in the right direction. And I want to thank you again, Phil, for keeping this story alive, not just from 9/11, but the things, everyday things that the cops and the first responders and military do. And in this day and age with the politics, it's hard for them to do their jobs. And frankly, not to get political, but for those who want to defund the police, when there's a crisis in your family, guess what? Bye.
Well, thank you for that. And thank you for coming on the podcast and sharing that incredible story. I'm sure our listeners really enjoyed it and related to it. And I'm glad I got a chance to meet you and hear your story.
So same here. One more thing. Go Yankees.
Yes, ma'am.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please take a minute and give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or whichever podcast platform you're listening on. Stories from the Road is a Brown Dogs Media Group production. This one-man show is written, edited, and produced by Phil Klein. If you have a story you would like to share, please contact us at storiesfromtheroadpodcast@gmail.com. To learn more about this or other podcasts we're producing, please visit browndogsmedia.com. Thank you for listening.